The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Cool, let's just do it one more time.
Why?
Because we love making movies!
Hey everybody, I'm Aaron Gelabolo and welcome to my podcast, Because We Love Making Movies. So today we're welcoming back film editor Brett Bachman. The first time we spoke, we talked about his whole career, including his work with Spectrevision and the new film Pig. But today I wanted to do a deep dive into a horror film he edited called The Vigil. It's written and directed by Keith Thomas, photographed by Zach Cooperstein, and it's just a wonderfully unique movie. If you haven't seen it yet, pause this and go watch it. Otherwise, welcome back, Brett.
Hello. Good to be back. Thank you.
Great to have you back. Thank you for doing this. So I love horror films because I grew up on them. Films like Texas Chainsaw Massacre or Nightmare on Elm Street, The Thing, The Exorcist. You know, I'm also a lifelong fan of Stephen King. And it's actually through Stephen King that I learned, you know, horror stories and films only work if you care about the people at the heart of them. You know, for instance, The Exorcist is about a mom trying to cure her sick kid. You know, that's really the crux of the film. And it's kind of only a traditional horror film for the last, 20 minutes, but it's obviously one of the great horror films of all time. And, you know, for me, this film, The Vigil, really turns on such a beautiful premise grounded in emotion and also the emotional life of the main character who we learn about as the story unfolds. And so I guess maybe for the viewers, tell us what The Vigil is about.
Oh, thanks so much, Aaron. I think it's about grief. I think it's about finding courage. I think it's about hope. The film, the story being centered around this young man who leaves his old life behind. He grows up in the Hasidic neighborhood in New York and makes a very difficult choice to leave behind his former community, his religion, his lifestyle, his community. And when people do that, they become ostracized. They are often leaving loved ones behind, friends behind. And after a personal disaster happens to his family, he leaves. And through financial hardship, takes a job that requires him to reenter the community for one night, performing the vigil, being a shomer for an evening. And those unfamiliar with the practice, like I was, I've been a goy for 34 years. I was very unfamiliar with this entire practice and the stories behind it and the rituals. And so when someone in the Jewish community dies, the body is often left in the house overnight, and a guardian, a vigil, sits and reads prayers. And in our movie, in our story, when Jacob comes back to the house, he discovers this entity has latched itself on to this victim and forces him to confront a lot of the grief and the trauma that he's been fleeing from his own life, and threatens to latch onto him as a parasite.
Yeah. And it's a movie that, you know, for those of you who haven't seen it, what I love about it is that, you know, it starts out with this very kind of mysterious opening that we learn about what that is later, sort of set, you can kind of ascertain that it's set in World War II. But, from a filmmaking perspective, I love the sense of breaths that go to fades to dark, to dark, fades to black. And we hear the breaths and we understand it's someone's point of view. We don't know whose point of view it is. And it's this traumatic thing that you see. And then you come into the present and you meet Jakob, and you know, he's immediately in a bathroom taking medication. And so, like you said, he's this guy who's not only ostracized by his religious community, but he's also living in modern society with all of its modern problems. You know, he's got anxiety, he's medicated, he's dealing with a lot of the things that everyone deals with on top of sort of being alone now in the world, apart from his sort of community and faith. And I also, again, it's like a lot of your work, it has this really wonderful humanity that it starts with, so that we're grounded in it. And the scene of just everybody, all of these people who are sort of who are Jewish, who have left their community to try and live in modern society, sitting around a table and talking and having this conversation that goes in and out of Hebrew, is really so funny and poignant and sad. And you really see, you kind of, from the one story that Jakob tells you, which is that, you know, he went to try and get a job, and he didn't have a resume, and he was writing it on a note paper, and you know immediately who this guy is and what he's dealing with, you know. And then from there he gets approached by someone from the community to sit this vigil. And that guy's a wonderful actor too, who kind of plays sort of the Hasidic. He's not a rabbi. He's much more of like a community sort of figure, right?
I don't know in the greater context of the story. I actually think he is a rabbi, or he was a rabbi in real life. But yeah, that footsteps meeting, those actually happen. These are real meetings that do occur a lot.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In the film, some of the actors at that table are not actors. They're not professional actors in the sense. A lot of them are actually former members of the Hasidic community that appear in the film. The actress that plays Sarah was in the Hasidic community before she left. Wow. And a lot of those other people around the table are directly from that community that have decided to leave. Keith, our director, based this meeting off of real meetings that do occur just like this. It ended up proving to be one of our more challenging scenes in the film, which overall was the editorial process went very smoothly. But this one particular scene was one of the more challenging ones to kind of nail all these points of view, mm-hmm. with making sure you're understanding what this community is about, where Jakob is coming from, nailing the point of view of the scene, feeling that humanity, setting the world, but also doing so in a way that just doesn't kind of blatantly come out with exposition. We're kind of trying to kind of lead the audience a little bit, kind of set the tone, set the world, without kind of being explicit about here's where we are, here's what's going on. We're giving them some trust that would allow them to catch up with us, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's so interesting that it was the most difficult scene, because it seems like one of the most effortless scenes in the movie, and it's such a lovely, delicate, elegant scene. Like I said, they sort of like you, and you do. It's nice you do catch up, because the more you get details in that scene, you're like, oh, I see, I understand. But let's back up for a second. So you mentioned Keith Thomas, the director. So how did you meet Keith Thomas, and how did you come to edit The Vigil?
Yeah. So The Vigil was the very first script that my agent ever sent me.
Wow.
I was, after the success of Mandy, I attracted the attention of my agent over at UTA. And after finishing a film called Daniel Isn't Real, where I was just like doing back-to-back Spectre Vision projects, he was like, I want to get you on something else. I want to meet some more people if you're into that. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I want you to take a look at this. It's not a large movie, but it's extremely well written. And I think you would do really well with it. And he sent me the script. He sent me a lookbook. And the entire concept really fascinated me and hooked me. There was a lot of humanity to it. It was very frightening. I loved also kind of the mystery element of it as well, where you're gradually discovering what is going on inside of this house. And it worked for me on so many levels. Mm-hmm. I had a really brief phone call with Keith where, you know, we kind of mutually he was really familiar with my work. And I mean, this being Keith's first feature, he was extremely, extremely collaborative and excited to work together. And we hit it off right away. I wrapped editorial on Daniel's Unreal. And just in a matter of, I think, a few weeks later, I was receiving dailies from New York.
Wow. Wow. That's so cool. And Keith Thomas, for anyone who doesn't know, you know, I think he's a really great up and coming director. I mean, I actually saw his at least the short that made the rounds called Arcane.
Oh yeah.
Which is a really scary, intense short and has sort of shades of the Vigil in it. And, you know, I mean, it's a little different, but I remember being so excited for this movie because I'd seen that short and I said, wow, this movie's going to be scary. And I do love the fact that the movie is a mystery. You know, there's no sort of setup, boogeyman setup. You know, there's no sort of, oh, this is what's going to happen, or this is the tale of the demon and the blah, blah, blah. So that's really, it's really fresh in that way, you know, particularly because of the world. And I guess, so what were your sort of first conversations with Keith about in terms of, you know, the script and the tone of the movie and just how you guys were going to approach it?
Yeah. We talked, I think some of the very, very first conversation was like, I don't speak a word of Hebrew. is that going to be okay? Are you sure you still want me on this? And he's like, we'll make it up as we go. You'll have the script with you. I like your sensibilities. I like your tone. I like the stuff you worked on. Yeah. So that we had to get that out of the way, like, immediately.
Right.
And the thing that hooked me in the script immediately, the thing that like really resonated with me, that kind of noodled the twain in my brain, was the midpoint scene, the scene in the basement where Yakov goes downstairs. Mm. He finds the video of Mr. Litvak talking about this thing that's followed him home from Europe. And you're kind of caught up with the mythology. And Yakov realizes the plight that he is in. There was something that was so kind of chilling about that scene, but also there's a sense of dramatic irony going on where you know it's not a good idea to go down to the basement, and yet you really want him to at the same time. You want to figure, you want to find out what's going on. And I just, that scene really just kind of stuck with me, you know, several days after reading. And so there wasn't much discussion in terms of references or execution from Keith and, you know, how I want you to take this, how I feel this take or that take. It was a relatively hands-off assembly process. Nice. I was sent a big chunk of dailies over in Los Angeles, and they were doing production over in New York. And I kind of had free rein for about 4 weeks to put together this first cut. And it was, for those who've seen the movie, you'll know it's a relatively small, contained story. It takes place more or less in two locations with, you know, a travel sequence in the first act. And it was a really fun opportunity to kind of sit with material for about a month, look at dailies, and just kind of bring my own interpretation of the material and present it to Keith, which fortunately resulted in probably one of the easiest director's cuts I've ever done in my entire life.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, we had most director's cuts, you know, by DGA timelines will go for about 10 weeks. We did the director's cut for Vigil in under 2.
Wow. Holy shit.
Keith saw the assembly. He was extremely happy with where it was at, with the progress. He was executing on all of the things the film needed to do. It was scary. It was emotional. The characters' work, the acting from Dave and everybody was top notch. And so there really, Keith came in and he was like, I actually don't have that much I want to do. Like we worked together for about a week and a half. Then he had, you know, things here or there we wanted to work on together, some timing things, some performances, clarify some things, rewrite some of the, clarify some of the subtitles where I just gotten the translations completely wrong,
right.
Which happened. And then we presented the producers like only about 2 weeks after Keith traveled over from Colorado where he lives. And then producers saw it and kind of the same thing, you know, extremely happy with where it was at. But then they wanted to start testing. And so we had like a small friends or family screening in a rented theater to work on some things, calibrate some moments here or there. But the editorial process for this was remarkably fast, very smooth. Mm-hmm. And I hope I'll have another project at some point in the near future that, or in my life, that'll go as smoothly as this one did.
Right. And now I'm curious, do you think that had to do with, because it feels to me like it was a very tightly written script. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, do you think that had something to do with the fact that, you know, a lot of this movie was realized on the page and obviously in the shooting, but that it wasn't like you were having to sort of do restructuring in the edit and it kind of came out as it was meant to be a certain degree?
No doubt. I mean, I think the only reason this edit went as smooth as it did was because of the production team, you know, knowing exactly what they wanted and doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, down to, you know, Keith's writing, to Zach's photography, and, you know, his mm-hmm. experience with, you know, working with Keith on set to get the right coverage for the story beats. Mm-hmm. The movie executed all of its objectives. It was scary. It was well-written. It was compelling. So the things that, you know, you have to achieve when doing a horror movie or doing a genre movie, or just any movie altogether, it worked. I think that was because of its small scale, of its, the ability of the script, and the acting, it goes without saying. I mean, with Dave's performance in this, I think, was extremely nuanced, and I didn't realize this was an accent for him the entire time.
Wow, like really?
That's a voice he came up with for the film, and he, a lot of times in the edit, you have to work around actors, and you have to kind of you know, juggle the tone of the film with an actor's performance and getting the kind of all kind of meshed together. We had none of that on this film. Kind of like a very easy puzzle, just kind of slipped together, more or less.
Wow.
There are things we calibrated and things we work on specifically in the edit, but it's just one of those situations where a lot of your first tries work, which that's cool that this kind of came together the way it did.
No, yeah, and that makes sense. I mean, because it's such a strong film, and so I guess the other thing I wanted to ask before we kind of get into like specific technical stuff is that, you know, when you read the script, you know, what did you kind of see as, oh, okay, this is an opportunity, I'm excited to do this, and what did you also see as sort of, oh, this is a pitfall, this is a place where we can really fuck it up if we're not careful? I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, with the Mazik in particular, this creature, the demon, this entity that is our monster, our villain throughout the film, it was going to be really important to get that right, to get the balance, this ambiguity of the threat as well. We have this kind of ongoing storyline that, you know, Yakov is going through, like you said earlier, a lot of mental health issues. He's going through panic attacks. And so juggling the ambiguity of that with also the potential presence of this thing was very important. Making sure we nail the inner character arc was also very important, because at the end, that's what's really going to resonate as a transformation arc, is to see that Yakov leaves this experience changed. And so unless we can get that right with him, you know, we tell this story through flashbacks of how this accident occurred, where his brother is, you know, killed in this, you know, accident, and making sure we're able to kind of chart that trajectory of him building the courage, of him being able to forgive himself throughout this night was very important. The finale, I think, was also something we knew had to work with, the special effects of the creature, with the walls pushing in on him, there's also a sequence which was one of, I think, the most challenging things for them to shoot, which was a sequence about 2/3 through the film where Yakov decides to leave the haunted house. He does that thing where everybody just says, well, why don't you just leave? And he does. He discovers that he has been in the house too long, and this thing has latched onto him, and he can't leave without, you know, he can't leave without incurring some kind of torment or some kind of, you know, potentially death. And this thing forces him back.
Yeah, it's like this arthritic kind of thing where his limbs don't work and he's cracking, and it's almost like he's turning into the corpse or something, or the old man, or it's such a cool, frightening effect.
They were supposed to have an entire night to shoot this sequence. They had all the permits, they had everything set aside. They started shooting it, and I think they were probably 2 hours, 3 hours in. And the NYPD shows up and they're like, "You're getting noise complaints. We don't care. You have a permit. You have an hour, and then we're shutting you down." So Keith, it wasn't often that like Keith called me from set to be like, "Hey, we got a thing, we got a problem." But on this particular day, he's like, "Hey, so we only were able to shoot about a third of our day. I only got about, 20% of the shots that I wanted. And the other 80% were stuff that Zach and I just had to run and gun and just shoot the material, shoot as fast as possible. So please let me know if we have something. I'm extremely concerned about it. I'm not positive we have the sequence." Wow. And so that was definitely something in terms of that could have been a pitfall in the edit, but fortunately they did it. Like they got the right material and we got in the can.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's almost like that's really impressive, because it doesn't seem like that at all when you watch the film. It feels like a full journey out of the house and back, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about was, I guess two things that really stand out to me sort of overall. First is a little bit of a subtle thing that, I love when they kind of, once you leave the sort of the meeting with the sort of Jewish people who are outside of the community, there's this great POV shot that kind of finds the rabbi, and you kind of get this sense. It's the first time you hear kind of the haunting score, which is a really great score.
Oh yeah.
Really, really great. And the camera's kind of floating towards the rabbi, and you realize it's POV to a certain degree of Jacob and his friend. And then when they finally go to the house where he's going to sit the vigil, there's this great shot that's sort of out on the street of this apartment. They're very simple, apartments, but the score comes in and it almost feels like kind of those shots from sort of the beginning of The Exorcist or even the beginning of Hereditary, where it's almost like it's the demon's point of view. Mm-hmm. But it's really haunting, and it sets up, I don't know how you guys were approaching those shots in terms of, point of view and feeling and mood, but they certainly achieved this feeling of dread. And the other thing that is a sort of a bigger thing to talk about is, he basically sits there for 5 hours in the movie. And a lot of movies, have kind of this, a real time sort of, clock ticking. And it's got a faster pace because of that, because, we're rushing through the night. This, you guys do this thing here where you're elongating time because it's the sense of waiting.
Yeah.
And then time stretches even further because it's supernatural. And so a lot of the shots are very long and the moments are very long. And so was that something that you guys, was built in, or, and how did you approach that? Because it carries through the whole film. So, mm-hmm. It's, I was just curious, because that seems to be really like, this is the definition of slow burn, and creating tension.
Yeah. One of my favorite things about how the film was shot was that it does a great job of oscillating between this third person, almost omniscient point of view, where you're seeing wider tableau shots where you don't know whose point of view there are, or you're experiencing things on the flip side of that, a very limited point of view. You're only seeing what Yakov does. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think the film does really well is when it changes between those two. So, coming up, for instance, in the opening of when they're coming to Mrs. Lipbox's house, and you have the white exterior, and you're coming in, and you have that dolly coming from camera left over to the right, and you reveal the body. There certainly is, and it is intentional to have some almost malevolent point of view to that. We do want to, it is intentional to kind of create this idea of someone is watching, something is following them. Mm-hmm. And this occurs throughout the film as well, when Yakov is texting and we have, the camera set up in the corner of the room from far away, and you have different elements of space that are kind of framing the different rooms. And that's meant to kind of invoke that, yes, something could theoretically, it's meant to give you that idea that something could be in the back, or something showing how large this house is. And, you know, James Wan will do this a lot, but and he talks about this when he will frame things particularly wide to kind of allow your eye to explore. I mean, the film Vigil, I think, definitely does something like that as well. And that's the thing that we consciously do where, for instance, you know, when he's on the phone talking to Sarah and they're doing a FaceTime and he discovers that this thing that he's talking to might not be Sarah. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. we're doing most of this conversation, you know, in kind of a close-up pattern and a reverse, you know, close up on him, insert on the iPhone for Sarah, back and forth, back and forth. And then at one point in this conversation, we cut out to a wide and we just hold in that wide for a little bit too long. And that's totally, totally intentional. Like we want the audience's eye to be repurposed. And now they were thinking about the conversation. Now we want them to think about the room. We want them to think about what's in the room. Is there something in the shadows? Is there something, you know, behind the camera? We want them to be suddenly thrown off guard and, you know, put off balance. So those are definitely totally intentional when we switch between those two. And, you know, the question of point of view is something we always have to talk about when it comes down to horror, when it comes down to building dread and suspense. And that's something that I think is extremely important in pacing as well. And so you, when you look at, you know, him interacting with his phone or looking at the body or him in the kitchen freaking out, these scenes are, you know, paced very carefully because I think one of the most important things in horror, especially if you want to throw the audience off guard, isn't what is happening, but what could happen. Like tossing out this notion, this expectation that at any point something could change dramatically. And if you have a horror film or a moment that is paced in a way that is giving you the information at a faster rate than normal, then there's no time for you to kind of build that suspense, to build that dread. You're just following story beats. You need, it's kind of like it's just an engine you very carefully have to manufacture and work with and adjust and, you know, go through versions to constantly kind of throw the audience off guard, to allow their eye to explore. Because, you know, building dread, building scares is 90% of making something frightening, in my opinion.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not just, you know, I mean, as much as I love a jump scare and I love a loud bang and I love like a sting, that's only 10% of the equation. You have to have the 90% buildup and the idea that something is going on, something is happening, something is about to happen. And that's, well, camera work, that's acting. But also, I think pacing is such an integral part of that.
And it's so funny you said that about the kind of like what could happen, because I think two things. You guys use cell phones in a very, very interesting way in the movie, because it's what I like about it is it's very much kind of Jakob's interior point of view to a certain degree. Like the first time we see him turn on music and start tech, because he's met this girl at the footsteps meeting, you know, in the beginning of the movie, who's interested in him, who asks him to coffee. And I love that line when he says, "I don't drink coffee." She's like, "Maybe tea." You know, like it's like, buddy, you know, he's, and so when he's texting with her, first, before he starts texting with her, he's Googling how to talk to women, you know, and it's such a great way to just be like, oh boy, this poor guy. And then he's texting with her and he says, oh, I should stop texting. And then the lights start flickering, right? Lights start flickering. And we've had some tension moments up to that. And then he goes to the light bulb and he tries to like futz with it and it pops and he's in the dark. And then his phone buzzes again and you're like, oh, it's the girl. And it's not. It's this video of him being watched as if the demon has a camera or is like has his phone. And it's so well done, man. It was all that. That's all in the script as well, I assume.
Oh, yeah. I mean, these progressions. And I think one of the things the script does really well, and Keith was amazing at, was how to thread out and how to build up and how to escalate a scene with progressive events happening that will just build to a crescendo. So that particular sequence, for instance, is kind of in the long line of things within that first act that, you know, throw Yakov's sense of his safety off guard. And, you know, it's him finding the photo. It's him with the light bulb. all building up into this vision he has
in
the kitchen. At this point in the story, I think he's more concerned. We kind of approach it that he's more concerned that it's not necessarily an entity, but it's Mrs. Litvak, you know, checking up on him, you know, her recording him, and you know, as kind of like a scolding method, because like, I saw you asleep on the job. You're not supposed to be. You're not supposed to be asleep. How rude of you! I'm going to have you fired or something. But Keith does a great job at kind of laying out these respective beats that gradually turn into something much more sinister. And all that was in the script. We really have to. We assisted certainly in the edit, but all of that was charted out really well by him.
The other part of this movie, apart from, you know, the scares, which are really beautifully architected, is the acting and the performance. And obviously we're talking about Dave Davis, who plays Jakob, who I had no idea that was an accent, which is really impressive, to the, you know, to the rabbi, to every, really all of those young characters. But then we get to Lynn Cohen, who, you know, may she rest in peace. She's a, you know, terrific actress. I mean, I first became aware of her in Spielberg's Munich when she played Golda Meir, and she's so brilliant in that. And she's so wonderful in this. And so what was it like editing her performances, and you know, how did you approach that? Because she just seems like she's so unpredictable in not in a bad way, but in a way that like she's got that kind of, I don't know, actor studio thing where she's going to give you something so alive every take. And what was that like?
It was a bit unpredictable with her. And yeah, working with Lynn, there was certainly an unpredictable nature to working with her, and that's intentional. Like you're at the point in the movie where hopefully you're not sure whether or not this thing that Jakob is experiencing is some kind of, you know, external malevolent force, some kind of entity, or if he's going crazy, or if he's experiencing a mental health breakdown. And he's in a house with this old woman who lives alone, that's a widow, that he's been told, like, oh, she has dementia, and so she might be seeing things as well. And so I think Lynn does a great job of kind of channeling this kind of dance on this razor's edge of, you're not sure whether or not she is an old woman who is grieving that may have dementia, or if she is also haunted by something and she's this harbinger trying to warn him out, and how she fluctuates between, you know, channeling this earnest warning, but with also, you know, this, these kind of contrasting emotional levels where she could be heightened at one moment and then soft and gentle the other. You're not really sure how to place her. And I think it's one of the magnetic things about that character, that she keeps you guessing up until the very end, up until that point where she gives Jakob that little bit of courage before Jakob has his final face down with the entity. You don't know where she's, you don't really know who she is, where she's coming from, if she's telling the truth. And Lynn kind of did a phenomenal job at balancing those two.
Yeah, and what's interesting about what you just said there is that when in the kitchen, well, actually, from the start, she's sort of like, no, he has to leave, right? You have to go. You won't do. You should leave now. And then later on, she's saying, you know, you should leave. And she's actually warning him.
Yeah.
It's not, I want you, you think it's, oh, leave because he's not right, or leave because, oh, she's this old woman who might have mental illness issues, or she's not in her right mind. But she's actually, her clarity when it comes to her husband and the demon is always there. Mm-hmm. And when you go back and rewatch the movie, you realize that the whole time she's telling you the truth. And you know, it kind of reminds me of, there's these sort of heartbreaking stories written by this author, Jonathan Franzen, because his father had dementia. And he said the worst part about it was that he would sort of make no sense for long, long stretches. And then all of a sudden, he would have a moment of clarity and a memory that would just hit Jonathan Franzen like a knife, you know. And I think she does this thing where she's balancing out, like you said, it's like, wait a minute, is she telling the truth or exactly. not? And yeah,
exactly. She's meant to kind of be that unreliable narrator type. Mm-hmm, you're not sure what to take from her as fact and what is manufactured. She's talking about her husband being haunted by something. Am I supposed to take this literally? Is this an allegory? Is this, you know, her kind of spinning off into something? And that, and then, you know, finding moments of inspiration, finding the moment where it's an astute high energy warning, or if she's tapping into something that is extremely painful that she's been going through for the last, you know, 50, 60 years of her life. And she did a really great job at oscillating between those two.
Yeah, completely amazing. And it's also the fact that it's like, you know, I think like an intent, it's like, don't sort of play the intention. You don't want an actor to sort of play the intention like they're pretending at it. It's like she's playing every moment as if it's true. You know, it's in, and in that regard, it feels like when she's saying, oh, this is not a place for children to live and I drove them away. Well, that could be that her husband was an abusive monster, not necessarily that there's a demon. You know, it could read just as powerfully as if we're talking about something real, as if we're talking about something supernatural. I think that's where the power comes in it, you know, because it's scary because it's true. It's emotional because it's true. It's not because she's just acting in, you know, acting in a certain way. So it's a really remarkable performance. Yeah, amazing. Particularly because she's just such a talented actress. You know, she really has that, and her face is just so wonderful. You know, it's like it's on camera, particularly in that role. It's really a great performance. And I guess, you know, the Dave Davis performance, just, I just want to talk about a little bit, because to me, it's like, it's such a, it has no vanity, you know, like, it's like people talk about, everybody talks in The Godfather about like Michael and Sonny and Marlon Brando. And they said, you know, but John Cazale's performance as Fredo is sort of it's the role no one would want to take, you know, because he's perceived as weak and he's perceived as flawed. And he's sort of like, you know, kind of a grown up baby. And Dave really approaches, you know, a lot of his performance from this perspective. And it's just got such humanity and empathy. And, you know, I guess talk about, you know, cutting his performances and what it was like to observe him, you know, create this character on screen, because it's really memorable.
Yeah. Where to start with Dave? He made it look so easy. Like, and he made it, he's very gifted. He's very talented. And it's such a joy as an editor when you look at a performance and you're working with a performance in tandem with someone who you never meet in real life, or at least I hadn't met Dave at that point in my life. Mm-hmm. And every single take is great. And it is, there's no issue, there's no task, there's nothing to work around. And sometimes you take it for granted as editors, when you're looking at material and you're assembling it, that so much work and practice and rehearsals have gone into crafting this performance. And I don't think I realized it until we were maybe a week away from picture lock, you know, how much work had gone into, how much work David put in to bring this character to life, to learn his lines in Hebrew, to, you know, fully and capture this guy's story for one night, and the places that he takes it. He has to have a very wide range of emotions for Yakov, you know, whether it is, you know, channeling an inner panic attack to, you know, trying to flirt, or oscillating between outright terror and grief, and, you know, sometimes doing this all within one take. There's one take in particular I'm thinking of, in one moment in the film, where he's, after he's tried to escape from the house, and he's waking up and he's talking with Sarah on the phone. Uh-huh. He is startled by that. He sees a vision of the body raising up out of the linen sheet, and then he's in a full breakdown and tears are coming out, and he's at his lowest point he's probably been in his entire life. And he channels all of this within the span of just a few minutes. And I was taking a lot of that for granted in assembling that. And it's only when I look back at it now, and you're like, a person had to do this. A man had to rehearse these things and had the ability to kind of channel all that stuff, that I realize how much of a phenomenal actor he really is. He brings such humanity and inability for the audience to empathize with him, that you you hope to have every actor as good as Dave Davis in, if that makes any sense.
No, it's absolutely. Okay. So I wanted to kind of just get into sort of the genre of it all. You know, in general, I guess a kind of a nerdy editing question. I'm just curious sort of, and maybe this might not apply to this film or other films, but you know, when you're assembling, do you prefer to start cutting without music and cut things silently? Or do you prefer to use, if you have score or temp score? And I've heard stories about Chris Nolan likes to cut the whole movie silently and just see if it's working. I'm just curious how you work.
I typically like to avoid temp music as long as possible. it's up until a certain point. There's usually kind of a happy point after about a month of working the director that we kind of start to bring, that I would like to bring stuff in, because then you start kind of thinking about the movie as a whole, as opposed to just kind of disparate scenes, when you first start doing the assembly, that's all it is. It is disparate scenes. You're working on, you know, scene 47 one day, and then the next day you're working on scene 82. Then on Thursday you're working on scene 2. And so it's all these things kind of out of flux, and you'll be working on these things for hours at a time. And then you look at everything together, and just the vast majority of the time, these scenes don't flow into one another. The movie has, you know, rhythm hiccups here or there, and it needs further calibration. And so one of the reasons I don't use temp music is music is, you know, a big momentum shift. It's a huge, when you use it, it can really change the rhythm of a piece. And so more often than not, when I start watching these assemblies with temp music, the rhythm of the movie would be thrown even more off. And mind you have, you know, score. It's also used, you know, to create scenes and the sequences, to blend several scenes together, to, you know, emphasize something that hopefully should be working in the material. And so I found that when I was using them on my earlier films, it was creating actually hindrances in the edit if you use it too early. And it's also more often than not maybe a crutch you lean on to build an emotion that should be in the story, that should be in the performances, that maybe you start relying on too soon. So with The Vigil in particular, I didn't use any temp music until I think that second week with Keith. I mentioned before this director's cut was only about 2 weeks before we brought in the producers to start working. So when Keith first saw this rough assembly I prepared, it had was source music, the stuff that you would, you know, like if you, Yakov puts on headphones and is listening to music, you know, you would hear that.
Okay.
But you wouldn't hear any, you know, temp or any cues, so to speak. That being said, I do use a lot of sound.
I was just about to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah. I when I do my rough assemblies, I spend a lot of time creating a sound bed. You know, whether that's through ambiences and backgrounds, or a combination of Foley or hard, not like a full Foley pass, mind you, but you know, whether it's hard effects. I like to create, when we talk about mood and ambience and dread, sound is at least 50% of that. And so as much as I don't like to, you know, utilize music because of its ways it can throw off rhythm, or it can be a bit driving with a tone, I think working with sound as early as possible is the flip side of that, where I would do that on my very first scenes, my very first cut of scenes. Typically I find, and when the director comes on board, then usually you're working on things kind of like a scene by scene basis with the director. So when Keith came on board and we started working on his director's cut, we would kind of go in a linear fashion, working on the prologue, working on the footsteps meeting, and kind of doing a scene at a time on the individual notes. And even then, music really isn't good to use, because you're still kind of adjusting things on a micro basis. You're not doing the full thing, the full film as a whole. I usually find there's a point where after you do that first full director's pass, and you're now, you've gone through every single scene, you've done that first round of the director's notes, then you watch the movie down, and that's kind of what I envision as like the first rough director's cut. And usually on a film that takes anywhere from 2 to 3 weeks to get to that point. But with Keith, because he had very little notes, we were able to get there in 1 week. Now is the time. Okay, let's think of this thing as a movie, as opposed to a bunch of individual scenes we're making notes on. And one of the big things we do at this point is start to talk about music, start to talk about how do you want to feel, how does, where can it help the film, where do we need it, where do we not want to have it, is also, I think, where to use music, where not to use music is just as important, where to use music. You don't want to use it in a place that would be overly sentimental or leading, or you want it to be used in a way that helps and not in a way that it's doing 90% of the work, you know? So we have all those conversations, and that's when on a film like Vigil, for instance, we brought in, Keith wanted a really kind of eclectic blend of electronic and strings. And so I remember we tempted with a lot of Annihilation, for instance. I think like most horror films in the last 10 years, we also tempted with Under the Skin. We kind of ran a big gamut of a lot of electronic and a lot of more traditional strings. And we spent a few days kind of layering stuff in, trying some things out, before, you know, bringing on Michael, who takes it to an entirely different level.
Yeah. It's very reminiscent of the Wendy Carlos stuff from The Shining, you know, which I know was kind of one of the first synth scores before people even really, now it's a total thing, you know, I mean, but that's so interesting. I mean, I think it's, and from the perspective of, you know, where does music go and where doesn't it go? I mean, I remember in some of my early short films, I would get obsessed with listening to scores, you know, and, but then I realized I was just listening to the score and not watching the movie and seeing where it actually went sometimes. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like you can get so carried away with music because it's so emotional. You know, like you said, it's this instant salve for something that's not working sometimes. And it's so easy to just, you know, because it's wonderful. It can elevate anything, you know, but should it, right, is the question.
Exactly. You don't want to be working on a scene and then fall in love with something and then realize 90% of why you liked it was because you had Inception underneath, or you had a temp from It Follows or something. That's what was working as opposed to your story.
Right, exactly. And I think it's so funny too, because I it's refreshing to hear you say that you avoid temp music, because I really think it's such a, I think it's a super disservice to composers, first of all, but I also think it can be this crutch, because it's like people fall in love with temp and they say, oh, can it just sound like that? It's like, well, that's John Williams. Like, what are you talking about? Yeah. Like this person we hired is going to give us their original thing, you know? Yeah. And so I always love those stories about filmmakers like Paul Thomas Anderson and Greta Gerwig, who, you know, they have John Bryan and those people on and in, you know, in prep, you know, so that if there is any music, it's their music, you know, which is of the spirit of the film.
It's kind of a necessary evil. Like it's been the way I've been describing it. I mean, and it really varies between composers, you know, their opinions on it. You know, when we first sent our rough scenes to, you know, Johan, he stipulated, please don't include any temp music. I want to view this thing cold. And I always try and give that option to composers. If I have the ability to put that forward to the producer and the director, hey, should so-and-so view this without temp? And I think most appreciate that. But I've also found that a lot of them really like having temp in there to kind of get to have the initiating point of that conversation of where do you view things structurally. It can be helpful as a communication tool to kind of clarify what you're meaning. So like on Color Out of Space, for instance, we proposed something similar to Colin Setzner, our composer, you know, we did a full spotting session with him. We kind of talked about where we want individual cues, and we sent him, I think, reels without temp in them. And then when we got to a point where we're really trying to dial stuff in the last like half an hour of the movie, and you know, the stuff wasn't those very initial passes, we're hoping for maybe a cue here, a cue here, a cue here. And he's like, well, go ahead and temp it. Go ahead and, you know, put stuff in so I get a sense of like what you're thinking about. And so, you know, we spent a day then working in some of Marco Beltrami's score and also some of Colin's stuff from Hereditary to work in, you know, kind of how we viewed the sequence could crescendo, where it would drop. What does the music do from in terms of to support the narrative going on as like that first conversation. And then we give that to Colin, and he's like, oh, okay, I see where you're like wanting to accelerate, decompress, ramp up, hold, all that stuff. And he's like, I got you, no problem. Let me crank out a version of that for you. But you know, some composers also completely hate it and they don't want any kind of, they want to view things completely cold. And like any artist and like any, you have to be kind of gauge it on a case by case basis.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's very, very true. Thank you. That was awesome. So I'm just curious, did you guys talk about, you know, did you talk about any horror movies? Did you reference, I mean, you said no in the, that he sort of didn't give you any sort of hard and fast references, but because I'm also curious, you know, are you a fan of horror movies? You know, what were sort of some of the movies either growing up or lately that you sort of make you say, oh, this horror can do something different. I'm just curious if you're a fan of the genre and if you guys did have any discussions about horror movies when you were getting ready to make this movie.
Growing up, I was not a fan of horror movies at all. I didn't like the sensation of being scared growing up. I really liked sci-fi. I loved, I was always a big fan of fantasy and science fiction, but I never liked the experience of being scared, but I was always fascinated by things paranormal. Like I was the kind of kid that would go to the library and check out as many books as he could on aliens and UFOs and ghosts, but read them in the safe of my own home. But I was so easily scared that I didn't like the experience of watching these things. So like, growing up in the 90s, you know, slasher movies were everywhere and you could not have dragged me to go see one of these things in theaters. I think, The thing that changed everything for me, though, and it didn't happen until I was, you know, in my 20s, you know, until I was actually at AFI. And I was a Sam Raimi fan. Like, although as much as I said I didn't like horror, I would watch the occasional one. So, like, I knew of Evil Dead, and I certainly I appreciated it. And I found a bit more kind of splatter, not necessarily scary so much, but, you know, more fun. And I had heard really good things about Drag Me to Hell. And so I rented it, brought it home, watched it on my laptop in my sparse Los Feliz apartment, and really enjoyed it. Had a lot of fun up until the very ending. And with the pits of hell being opened up and her being grabbed on by a demon and being dragged down and the movie ending on her screaming, help me, oh my God, help me, as like her flesh is being burned away and you cut to Justin Long's crying face and just like directed by Sam Raimi. like that, what the fuck ending? And like the nihilistic quality of the entire thing, like this thing, like all of this was for naught. Nothing matters. We're all just going to die. We're all fucked. Like there was something so startling and frightening and different about that ending that really screwed with me. Like I couldn't forget it for like 4 or 5 days after. I just kept on thinking about it and it haunted me. I mean, to use the term. And that was really the first point I saw. I saw myself, okay, let's open this door a little bit. If something has this power on me, I kind of like that something could do this, that something could really make me think this hard about something. And so that was kind of the genesis where I gradually began to kind of open myself back up to this entire genre that I had kind of written off as something that I just wasn't interested in.
Right.
And then it was throughout the next few years of, you know, watching a lot of different films at AFI, but also kind of in conjunction at the same time where I met the folks from Spectrevision and began to kind of work a lot in the genre space, did I begin to see what horror films in particular could do, what stories they could tell, what themes they could carry, and if they're done well, that frightening, resonating power they can have. And that to that day, I think that's why I really like things in the horror world, in the horror space. And don't get me wrong, as much as I love a fun, scary ride, I mean, horror comedies, I quite frankly have so much fun experiencing, watching and working on. But seeing a good, frightening, shake you to your bones, walk out of the theater feeling like you had a transformative experience I think you'll ask most people who get in the movies and they get into making these things and they want to work on something that gives people that kind of experience, that kind of transformative, mm-hmm. oh my God, I feel shaken, different, mm-hmm. you know, like something's kind of rewired in my brain. And I think mm-hmm. horror has such a fascinating way of doing that. Or at least yeah. the good ones, the great ones do.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember that the feeling of watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre and thinking to myself, is this a documentary? You know, is it real? Is this happening? But yet it has all these really wonderful cinematic touches. And then at the end, even though she escapes, you can tell she's crazy and she's going to be affected for the rest of her life, you know, or movies like, I mean, honestly, in the last, you know, 10 years, I mean, you know, The Witch and Hereditary mm-hmm. are just both movies that you just finish and you go, wow, I mean, this is totally unique, you know, or even a movie like Raw. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie.
I've heard amazing things.
And she's a French, she just actually won the Palme d'Or for her new film, it's called Titane, I think, or Titane, or anyway, Raw is another one of those movies where it has one of the best endings in terms of bringing everything together so that you just, like you said, you're shook, you know, and so you're thinking about it. And I think I love that about, you know, genre in general, is that it really, what it's trying to do is provoke you to think about something, you know, which The Vigil certainly does. Like, that's one of the cool things about this movie that I really think everybody should go and experience, because it deals with things like faith and hope and our existence in such a sly way that when it ends, you know, it's, you know, as many as horror films can be bleak and hopeless, this is not one of those films. You know, I try to always tell people like it's kind of nice when a movie that puts you through the ringer and you leave with a feeling of hope, you know, it's really interesting that it can do that, you know, which this film definitely does. Mm-hmm. And I guess a fun question to ask is like, is there a horror movie that you wish you'd have edited? It can be a classic.
I wish
or not.
I wish. I have edited. I've never been asked that question before. I've never even thought about that question before. I will say this. I don't think there's a film that channels the ability of entertainment value with the story of an adventure and fun and as scary and as like, you know, changing as Jaws is.
Oh, yeah.
Like that Jaws has everything you could want in a film. It's in a horror film.
It is. Yeah.
It's an adventure film. It's a horror film. It's a comedy. It is. It channels so much in such a short span of time. And also it's a film that changed so much about how we look at, for better and for worse, about the entire film business. I don't know if you could do a film like that could be made again. I would hope so. I believe in, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. I believe in our movies, but I think that's the first thing that comes to mind. It channels everything I love about horror films, everything I just love about movies in general to go see, entertaining character. Mm-hmm. Well-written characters, really well-executed story, perfectly paced. It handles its scares in a very tactful, not in an oblique or obvious way. Mm-hmm, it mm-hmm. gets under your skin. Very effective and minimalistic score, but also very lush and beautiful when it mm-hmm. needs to be. Mm-hmm. The film just has everything.
Yeah. Absolutely, man. Well said. That's I concur. I concur.
With everything you have on your plate, earning your degree online seems impossible. But at Grand Canyon University, we specialize in helping you fit a master's degree in education into your busy day. Your graduation team, led by your own GCU counselor, provides you with the personal support you need to succeed. Achieve your goals with a plan and team behind you. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Visit gcu.edu.